So last week I gave a little bit of a rundown on the background to Mark's Gospel, but we did not start with the beginning of Mark's Gospel last weekend. We started with chapter 13, which was the last words that he had, according to Mark, before he was led into Jerusalem and then began the journey of his passion, his death, and ultimately his resurrection. But today we go back 13 chapters to the very first words of Mark's Gospel. Now, I mentioned to you last week that Mark wrote his Gospel at the end, or towards the very end of the Jewish-Roman Wars. We know that because there's an allusion to the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem, and all of that comes into play. I also mentioned Nero and the burning of Rome and the beginning of the persecutions. So Mark's church, they were doing it very, very tough. But when I look at this gospel today, in the light of that little bit of history, let's try and give it a bit more context. I could spend a whole retreat with you on this part of Mark's gospel, because it's unique. Mark's is the, I said to you before, it's the oldest gospel. It is the only gospel that uses the words, the beginning of the good news. It's the only one that uses, that translates into gospel. It's the only one that does that. Now, you might think, well, so what? Well, so what is not good enough. Good news is translated from the Greek, in which the scriptures were written, and the good news in Greek is actually what we call euangelion, when we get the word eventually evangelical from it, evangelizers as we all are. That word is very important. Good news, or euangelion, it was the term that the Roman general would use, or the leader of an army would use, after a victory, and he would want to send a message back perhaps to Rome or to the next army that's behind him, and he would want to send a message back after they've had a victory in battle. So good news is that we've had a victory, we've won, pass it on. If I go back to the word that the Hebrew comes from, where we get the euangelion from as well, it actually means the bearer of good tidings. It's very technical, but the person who takes the good news. But if we look at Mark's gospel, it says the good news, so you know what that is now, about Jesus Christ. So we know what it is, we know who it is. And then we find out not only is Jesus is Jesus. The Christ means he's the anointed one. But what's the whole gospel about? It is about exactly that. Jesus Christ. End of story. And this is not a biography of Jesus' life in the sense that you and I understand biographies. This is the good news about Jesus Christ. And who is Jesus Christ? Mark tells us he is the Son of God. And you've got to get that, and I have to get that fairly and squarely in my head and my heart to understand Mark's gospel. Everything else relates to that. This is good news about the Son of God, who we know is the anointed one. The Hebrews would say Messiah, the anointed one, the Son of God, Jesus the Christ, the anointed one. So Mark, as I said last week, he doesn't give us any birth story. There's no donkeys and everything going on, no room at the inn. That's not important. Mark starts with his Jesus' adult mission, and Mark goes straight into it. He has not got time to mess around. And why is that? He hasn't got time to mess around because, if you remember, I said he's writing from Rome, the persecutions have begun. He is simply trying to make sure that what you have heard, his first audience, I've got to put it down because it's too important. We cannot lose this, because this what I'm giving you changes the world. The Son of God, Jesus Christ, who is the good news, is changing the world. The people needed to hear that because they were beginning this mighty suffering. There's a real urgency. That's why Mark didn't bother with all the nativity stuff. He's got to get into it because he's interested in salvation and actually saving lives. So there are two things here as I look at it. Two things about Mark's gospel and particularly this part. John the Baptist is introduced and then John is pulled back next. That'll happen next. It didn't happen today. But he's pulled back and Jesus is pushed forward. And John's language, I'm not even fit to undo his sandals. And then we will have the baptism of Jesus and then you will hear those words. This is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him. And next time you'll hear those exact words are when Jesus takes Peter, James and John up to the Mount of Transfiguration where he is transfigured before them and then through the cloud comes that voice again. This is my Son, the Beloved. This is Jesus Christ, my Son, the Son of God. You have received the good news. Be strong. So Mark's trying to give his people some courage because of the drama that they are living in at that time. If I then reflect on the other readings, well, the beautiful reading from Isaiah, the last part of that imagery is wonderful. If you've ever seen Middle Eastern shepherds, they wear a cloak and they've got other garments on underneath, not much, but the cloak is so important. It's really their most valuable asset is their cloak. But when they're shepherding, they go behind the sheep and they'll pick up a straggler and then in the cloak that they've got, they will form a fold, and it is in that fold that they'll pick up the stray lamb. And then they pick the lamb up and then they'll hold it like this. You may see an older lamb over the shoulders of the shepherd, but what Isaiah is saying there, this is our God. This is the God of mercy and justice, it gets all mentioned. I pick you up, I gently take you into my fold and I bring you over my heart. It's a beautiful image. And so don't ever put the good shepherd image in the sense of Australians and sheepdogs and motorbikes and stupid merino sheep. No, it's a really, excuse the pun, pastoral image where the shepherd embraces the little lamb. And we are those little lambs, particularly when we're hurting and we're suffering. It's a wonderful, wonderful image, is that of the shepherd and the sheep and us as the flock. We go on to the second letter of Peter. Now, I'll say it this way. It seems to me in the world that there are, reflecting on the readings and on Scripture as a whole, that there are two kinds of people. The first kind of person is those who I'd say who are afraid of the day of the Lord. And that's the language from Scripture. We are waiting for the day of the Lord. And there are people who are afraid of that. They are overpowered by perhaps a sense of judgment. And the other kind of people are those who cannot wait for the Lord. Bring it on. I don't care if my MasterCard's not paid for. Bring it on. I am ready to meet you. And in Mark's era, there would have been those two kinds of people. Those who wanted Jesus to return and take them to salvation immediately because this is a nightmare, what I'm living in. And then there would have been those that would have been part of the nightmare perhaps and said, look, I'm afraid of the day of the Lord because I know that I am going to be judged on how I live my life. And it seems to me with the Scriptures, Mark's gospel is written for those who are afraid or fearful of the last day. That might be some of you. And Peter's letter, second letter of Peter, is written for those who are not afraid of the last day. And so it's more than comfort. It's a letter of, hey, be patient. God doesn't wear a watch. Chill. Just relax. And in God's time, we can't talk about hours and days and years when we talk about God's time. So just learn to live with it and relax. So those people tend to enjoy life a little bit more because they are keen for what is coming. The mystery of life they've really thrown themselves into, but they are keen for that coming. They are not held back by a fear of the judgment, the last day. Now, in fairness, it would be right to say that perhaps the church over the years has put more emphasis on the judgment and the fear than what it has on hey, just relax. It's in God's time. It's going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it, about bringing the day of salvation forward. So just make sure that you are patient and that you're good with what you're doing with your time. We probably need to put more effort into that rather than the fear factor that so many of you were raised in. Everything from how we understand confession to how we come to communion. The people who, you know, are 80 years of age and say, look, I can't go to communion because I haven't been to confession. Oh, my goodness. And that sounds sad to me, but we taught our people that. We truly did. So I can't belittle that. So I will always try to meet that need if I can. But I'm not going to get anxious over it, because the first thing I'd be saying to you is, you faithful little lamb, you have nothing to worry about. And I know you're worried because we taught you to worry. And I'm trying to say today, take Peter's words. I know that there's a sense of urgency, because that's why Mark wrote his gospel, and we live with that sense of urgency. But Advent is really about a time of, oh, just relax. And make sure that in your life you do one of two things. You celebrate the presence of God, and I really mean this. You celebrate the presence of God, the fact that you are so close to God, every communion. At least try and do that. If you can't do that, then make sure that other people see God in you. They are the other two strands. There are those who are close to God, who feel close to God, and there are those whose very presence and what they do with their life is evidence that God exists. God is with us, Emmanuel. So there's a couple of things for us to work on during Advent there. If you feel a little discouraged, go back and read Peter's second letter again. If you feel that you're under a lot of pressure, you might want to reread the beginning of Mark's gospel. But you don't really have to go, I'm saying today, past those first words, the beginning of the good news about who? About Jesus Christ. Who is he? The Son of God. And if I really believe that, I will be joyous in celebrating it, and in my joy, people will see that I'm joyous in celebrating it. And God willing, by Christmas time, those people who are on the outside looking at us, perhaps even walking with us but from a distance, God willing, they will say, I want what she's got, or I want what he's got. And that is pure joy.